Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. And let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:38 p.m. on Thursday, January 27th, 2022. Present today, we've got Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter, Representative LeBon, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, myself, Co-Chair Foster, and Representative Rasmussen is going to be online. Are you online, Representative Rasmussen? She should be coming on shortly. And just a reminder, folks could mute their cell phones. And at this meeting, the committee will be doing two things. The committee will be adopting a committee substitute for House Bill 281, the operating budget, and that will be followed by a presentation from the legislative finance director, Alexi Painter, on the baseline budget and governor's 10-year plan. And Alexi is he calling in later? Or is here? Okay, great. And regarding the committee substitute, this is the governor's proposed budget with federal ARPA funding removed and replaced with UGF. And so essentially what we're doing is we're just taking out this one-time funding. We all always want to strive as much as possible to match recurring expenses with recurring revenue and not one-time revenue. It's my intent that this committee will address the use of these federal ARPA funds after the subcommittees have done their work. And the goal is, I think this takes a more conservative view of the budget. Removing these one-time ARPA funds will show that the budget has a deficit, and that's going to put pressure on us not to add a lot to the budget, and therefore hopefully it will result in a more fiscally conservative budget. So maybe with that, I would entertain a motion to put that before us. Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move that the House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 281 Finance, Work Draft 32-GH2686W, marks dated 1/27/22 as our working document.
Thank you, and I will object for the purpose of an explanation, and I'd like to call my staff up, Mr. Anderson. And what we have before us is version W. And so, Mr. Anderson, if you could walk us through, and folks, feel free to jump in at any time to ask questions.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Before you today is work draft version W. I'd like to just apologize for the kerfuffle this morning with version G. If you have G in front of you, make sure you put that off to the side. Make sure the active version is W. There was a technical error that was found after we disseminated information, so you should be working off of W. Mr. Co-Chair, before the committee today is committee substitute. This is a reflection of the process, is a reflection of a process more than a finished product. Alaska has received billions of dollars in federal aid and support through pandemic federal funds like CARES, CARISA, ARPA, and eventually the Investment and Infrastructure Bill. When the governor delivered his FY23 budget, it was a finished product reflecting both his priorities and the designation of funds for how he spends the various funds to pay for his budget. The legislature and this committee should also take that calculated approach of examining and prioritizing spending throughout the budget and then discuss the utilization of all the available funds comprehensively to include things like the ARPA replacement and other funds like the Investment and Infrastructure Bill. In order to do this, we need to roll back to a baseline budget similar to the governor's starting point and be able, he was able to go through his process and then build it back up. This CS replaces various federal funds and utilizes unrestricted general funds for spending. These changes include the following: an increase of $522.2 million spending of regular UGF, known as Fund Source Code 1004, a decrease of $82 million in federal fund sources that will become later known as IGEF, a decrease of $21 million of COVID relief funding, a decrease of $560,700 of CARISA funding, a decrease of $44.4 million of SLRF funding.
Mr. Anderson, are you referring to any one of the handouts that's, or?
Through the chair, Representative, I was just doing, I was still walking through my opening statements, and then I was going to refer specifically to documents, but we can jump immediately if you'd like to document number one, changes to from the Gov to House baseline CS.
In your introduction, did you have many more of those of what you're noting, and I assume those are all on number one?
The rest of my opening statements will be reflected in number one, so we could...
Go ahead and finish with your opening.
Leaving off at the CARISA funding, there is a decrease of $375 million of ARPA revenue replacement, which spends like UGF or unrestricted general funds. And this is why that UGF portion is so large that we will be reflecting in document number one. We also removed $7 million appropriation for ASME in cooperation with OMB. We also added $5 million of UGF for rate smoothing to match last year's budget structure. The net result of these changes are an increase of UGF by $146.8 million, a decrease of $148.8 million of combined federal funds, and it reflects a $2 million cut from all funds reflecting the governor's requested budget. Before the committee are four sets of documents, and we can go through each one. Number one is the document prepared in cooperation with Ledge Finance and the co-chair's office as a quick reference guide to reflect the funds that have been replaced and where they went. And at that point, Mr. Chair, I'd like to walk through document number one.
Okay, and Mr. Anderson, if you could just summarize in your opening statements what the net result of all of this is going to be, that the budget is going to show a deficit if you don't use federal ARPA funds, which are one-time funds. The budget will show a deficit of $350 million, correct?
Through the chair, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, that would be a question that we should direct towards Alexi Painter. In their fiscal summary, they reflected a $350 million pre-transfer deficit, and with some of these changes, it will be a little larger than 150, or excuse me, 350, but he would be better prepared to answer that question.
Okay, and we'll drill down to those details, but I think the overall picture that I think will emerge is you're going to see two numbers. You're going to see $375 million that the governor used, which was revenue replacement money for ARPA. And as Ledge Finance had presented, that really creates a deficit for the budget of $350 million. But then you're going to see a second number, which is ARPA funds are not just, you know, weren't just used for revenue replacement. They're also used for other things. And that totals a little over $500 million. So we'll figure out the subtleties of all of that once we get to Alexi Painter online. But again, I just want to reiterate, we will be using, or it is our intent, and we have to use the ARPA funds, so it's not like we're replacing those ARPA funds with UGF. That's not the intent. The intent is just to show that unless those funds are recurring each year, those are one-time funds, And so again, we want to try to put pressure on our subcommittee and all of us to try to keep in mind that this isn't a lot of extra money that we have in the budget. We should be trying to be fiscally conservative and how we move forward and not add a lot of money to programs that are going to be recurring when these federal ARPA funds are just one-time funds. So ultimately, that's the goal, is to try to keep pressure, downward pressure on spending. So with that, Mr. Anderson, if you could go ahead and go to number one.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Document number one, it's referred to as changes from the Gov to the House baseline CS. This document is prepared as a quick reference to orientate the members to the makeup of it. The first column is your item number, and then the next span are specific fund source codes that you will see that will go across, and then there is a net impact for some of the changes, and that final column is where we're found, where it's found in the bill. Section one, as a reminder, is section one is the number section, which will be what the subcommittees act on in their, when they go through the subcommittee process, they are adjusting the number section of the bill. So the first item is revenue replacement. You will see that there is an increase of $375.4 million of UGF and a decrement of $375.4 million. That's your revenue replacement, and it is found all in Section 1, and that has been removed and increased by UGF. Your second item is the ASME appropriation that was made last year that should not have been carried forward into this year. We worked with OMB to just drop it from this year's appropriation. The next item is DOC's DNA collection. The governor's request had used SLUR funding at $1.1 million. That has been changed back over to UGF for the time being. Next is Department of Labor workforce training. There was $10 million of SLRF appropriated there and has been changed over to the $10 million of UGF. DPS, VOCA, which stands for the Victims of Crimes Act, there was a $3.5 million SLRF appropriation, which is now UGF. I will roll all of the university items together, the drones, the heavy oil, and the rare earth minerals projects, totaling $10 million for drones, $5 for heavy oil, and $7.8 million for minerals, has all been switched from SLRF to UGF. We've added the $5 million of rate smoothing to UGF, which in cooperation with OMB's efforts to allow for rate changes and charges and things like that. Next is Department of Transportation's, the next two I'll combine together, which is the AHMS CY22 level and then the actual AHMS increase. Both of those are federal funds right now. Those are the potential IGA funds, the investment and infrastructure funds that we know are readily have been designated for the ferry. And those will come back in potentially if this committee decides to place those there. Right now, those have been moved over to UGF. And then finally, there is the DOT other COVID fund sources for a combined $21.8 million of actual COVID relief and also $560,000 for Federal Highway and Aviation CARISA funds. Those have both been moved over to UGF. So what this shows is your final line for total is, yes, there is an increase of $522.2 million of UGF that we've added to this budget to establish the true baseline of what the cost of this year's budget should be. At a later date, this committee will have the conversations about the use of all of the freed up $504 million of CARISA and ARPA funds that are now back on the table for redistribution at a later date, and that would be the decisions to be made around the committee. The summary below is the net result. So from all of these changes, you have a net result of an increase of $146.8 million increase of UGF. The federal decrease is $148.8 million, and then an actual reduction of $2 million in all funds to the governor's request. That's the summary cheat sheet for document number one.
And Mr. Anderson, if I could just, repeat what you said just to emphasize it, and that is that the governor has made his decision as to how he would like to spend the federal ARPA funds. Otherwise, this, the discretionary part is the SLRF is what we call that. And so what you're saying is we as the Finance Committee and as the House we'll make our decision as to how we would like to see that allocated. And so at this point, we've backed that out. Ms. Representative Ortiz had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anderson, could you just briefly, I know you kind of summarized it real quickly, but can you tell me how rate smoothing, what is that process, who does that process, and what's the purpose of it?
Through the chair, yes. Mr. Painter could probably expand it farther, but the idea of the rate smoothing was OMB had requested last year, and we approved in the budget last year for there to be a the ability of OMB to, as Department of Administration works with other departments on charges for things that, that DOA charges other departments, as they standardize rates and charges, there might be some fluctuations where they don't get it. There might be some inconsistencies or some things that they didn't quite account for. So this gives them the ability to hold both harmless as they work this process out. And we approved this last year, and this is a carry. This continues on with that practice for this year as they finish up the rate smoothing.
So to put it in simplistic terms, it would be a pot of money that they can use to kind of adjust and move and to where specific needs are met, where there was maybe a specific shortfall, that kind of thing. Is that right?
Through the chair, that is correct, Representative.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got Representative Edgman, Representative Carpenter, and Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just want to be on record to support the process that's going forward. I think it's the prudent way to begin building the budget back up for this year and perhaps implications further on. Is it fair, Mr. Anderson, on slide number one here that we're working off of, page number one, this last, some of this money we haven't got yet and won't get until we get federal guidelines. Is that true?
Through the chair, once again, I think Mr. Painter probably would have a better explanation, but the second column, the Fed 102, the 59.3 and the 22.6, that is the IJA, the investment and infrastructure, and I'm not sure at how much qualifications we have for designating that succinct amount, but that's the one that it would be in question on better guidance in the future.
Just real quickly, Mr. Co-Chairman, I wanted to sort of tease that out because in support of the approach we're taking as well, but the fact is that there could be the reality that if that is the case, we will not have this federal money. I mean, if we don't get the guidelines until later on in the session or perhaps others, we have to account for that fact. So that's the point I wanted to make.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It's always exciting to see how the next legislature rolls out the budget because it's never the same twice. So. Seems to make sense so far. I was wondering if we might be able to provide some clarity for folks watching by defining the fund codes on the top of the sheet, because nobody watching is going to know what a 1004 is. And there's several Fed columns. So if we could just make some layman's terms as to what those are, people might follow what we're talking about a little bit better.
I am a big fan of that. Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative. I will do my best and then maybe reach out for a lifeline to Mr. Painter or Ms. Cunningham. The budget, normally for the layman terms, most of the time when we refer to the budget and spending, we refer to it as general funds, federal funds, other, and DGF, right, or designated general funds. Those are your big four large blocks of money. So when I say that the budget is $11 billion of general funds, or $4 billion of federal funds, they kind of fall into those four categories. Below that, at a more minute level, those general blocks fall into specific fund sources that sort of a little bit better defined, as in federal funds. The federal government provides us funds, not just in specific large pots, but like developed or sent over through federal departments like transportation. So you have federal and highway aviation funds that would be designated as a fund source code. And so you have that lower level down, but when they're all wrapped up and packaged, they are just federal funds. So I think that's would be my limit of explanation, and then maybe Mr. Painter or Ms. Cunningham could give a better definition.
And so you don't know exactly, like you said, 1002 is simply the IGA funds, Fed funds, and then 1265, 1270, 1269.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Yes, so right now, 004 UGF is our main designated UGF fund. 002 is the general federal fund funds code right now. We don't have and once again, Mr. Payne will be able to explain, we don't have an infrastructure or investment fund source code yet. So that's why it's just designated as 1002 currently. 265 Fed is specifically the federal funds made available through the COVID, the specific COVID bill that applied, that states were able to get through the COVID bill. 1270 is federal highway and aviation CARISA funding made available through the federal CARISA bill. 1269 and 1271 are both applicable to the ARPA, or the American Rescue federal bill. Those two are broken up into 1269 is specifically your SLRF, which we know it as, and 1271 is the specific revenue replacement, specifically attached to the authorization that ARPA gives for states to replace revenue lost during the pandemic.
And if I could just say for folks watching, IGA is the federal infrastructure money that going to be coming to Alaska. We think it's about $1 billion or so. The CRISA money was the federal COVID money that was coming, but that fell more under the transportation, correct? Is that, and then ARPA SLRF is just another way of saying it's the discretionary money that we have more discretion over spending. And then, Representative Carpenter, any follow-up on that?
Just one clarification on the IGA funding. We don't know, there's stuff we don't know about it. I'm curious to know if that is because the federal agency hasn't given us the information, or the federal agency itself doesn't yet have the information, it's waiting on action from Congress. What is the, or is it a combination of the?
Through the chair, Representative, we are working with the Office of Management and Budget to actually have, hopefully as early as next week, an actual presentation from OMB walking through specifically the IGA, but also the rest of the COVID funds. It's my understanding right now that the bill has been passed and signed, and the federal agencies are working through guidelines and regulations and things like that. And as they formalize those, then they disseminate them, and it triggers the available money with the guidelines. But OMB would definitely be able to talk more succinctly about that.
Representative Josephson and then Representative Thompson.
Through the chair, really just a comment, but I've been a student of the governor's vetoes and written about them in an op-ed, et cetera. And I think this is a great exercise so we can really see, as you said, recurring need versus recurring revenue. And so I understand that this is somewhat preliminary, but I just wanted to voice some concern with the UA, the three items listed there, drones, heavy oil, and minerals. I think if based on past practice, the governor would veto those if they were funded through UGF. I just wanted to, even though I know this is very preliminary and the pieces will move over the course of the session, I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you. And it's very possible, you know, depending on the will of this committee, that, you know, we fund these with exactly how the governor funded them. But I think, as you said, this is an exercise in trying to, you know, change people's mindset and think of, you know, maybe trying not to add as much to the budget as we might if we thought that we had a small surplus in the budget. So thank you for that, Representative Thompson, then Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Excuse me. Mr. Anderson, I thank you for explaining some of the funding codes so people will understand more what they are. But there's so many different COVID funds sources already that it would be kind of nice to have, you know, have their different sources listed for each one of these eventually so we can understand them more, because there are so many different COVID funds that we are receiving or that potentially going to receive. So it would be nice to be able to have a more listed look at those different funding sources.
Through the chair, Representative, I can work with legislative finance to definitely accommodate it, especially and specifically for document number one, but also going forward with all the different various COVID fund sources and all of the increase of federal spending that has created fund source codes. I can work with Ledge Finance on that.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm pretty well tracking most of what's going on here, in that you're taking all the federal funded items in the budget and putting into UGF just for sort of clarity and bookkeeping, and some of them may go back to federal funding. As Representative Josephson mentioned, some of the UA research projects, perhaps the ferry money from IJA that was designated ferry money, which probably is, I feel confident that it will end up at the ferries. I guess my question is two parts. on the far left column, from the, I guess the very top line, revenue replacement, which my understanding is leftover ARPA money from the $1 billion deposit from the federal government, that was, we used some last year, we're going to use some this year. Is this still part of the bookkeeping exercise? Because I thought that 375 revenue replacement was specifically for putting in a operating budget using federal funds. So to use UGF for that revenue replacement seems sort of a misnomer, in that it truly is for that purpose. I guess that's my first question. So the total at the bottom of 146 makes sense if you don't use that 375 in there. I guess you can answer that question first, and then I'll ask you my second one.
Through the chair, Representative, you are correct with the revenue replacement was part of the ARPA funds that last year there was conversation about splitting it up between $500 million last year and $500 million going into FY23. After the spend that we did in FY22, that left about $504 million. No, it's going.
You're right.
left on the table. Out of that 504, in the governor's budget, he exhausted all of the usage of that 504, 375 of it, in revenue replacement. And so by backing that back out, you can have a full comprehensive, as the committee, you can have a full comprehensive conversation about how much to use in revenue replacement. Last year, just so for the committee's edification, we used 250 of it for revenue replacement last year. The governor added an additional 125 on top of that. Is that the will of this committee? That will be a decision for this body to make.
Well, yeah, thank you, follow up. So of that monies, the 500, 500, 375, whatever, that has a timeline. That's a use it or lose it proposition. If we don't use it by the end of a certain time period, is that?
And I believe Mr. Painter can clarify if I'm wrong, but I believe it goes through FY24 actually. So we could, it could carry over into one more fiscal year, I believe. But the idea last year was 500 in each of the next fiscal years.
Okay, thank you. And this is a separate question. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Through the chair. So the only other items, I guess I have a question about. You have the $5 million in rate smoothing, which we went over, and you have a $7 million. That's just a straight-up cut. Is that correct? That's not a money moving. That's an ASME. They're not getting that money.
Through the chair, that is correct. It was a one-time item last year, and it was a residual hangover this year. And so working with OMB, it was decided to remove it now because it was only supposed to be a one-time item.
Okay, in the lineup, I've got Representative Johnson and then Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, through the chair, would it be fair to say that the governor's budget followed the lead of the legislature from last year to create a hybrid, integrating the money into operations and programs from last year, from FY22?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, the governor did follow the same, especially when it came to the revenue sharing, the revenue replacement. He did follow suit, used the 250 that we had used and placed in the departments at the same location, and then just built on top of that. So, yes, through the chair.
So then my one concern then would be the FY22 management plan, that the numbers for that we have in our, like sheet two and so on, that unless we back the COVID money out of that number, we're not really comparing apples to apples.
Through the chair, that might be a better question to be addressed by Mr. Painter or Ms. Cunningham on the comparison equality.
And Representative Johnson, I'm looking at sheet number two, and I'm looking at the 22 management plan. Is that the column one? And it does show a deficit of $392 million. Is that the column that you're referring to?
Yes, just generally anything under that column would need that COVID money to be backed out of there to be
I think
similar
it is,
to the other one.
I think it is backed out. The governor's budget had essentially a balanced budget, $26 million surplus, and this shows the $392 million deficit. So I think the federal ARPA funds are backed out.
Mr. Chairman, maybe a good time to explain document number two and document number three. Document number three is a comparison of, excuse me, document number two is the comparison of all funds. And then document number three is your comparison of just UGF. So if you're looking at document number two, the only real change of all funds you'll notice is that $2 million decrement found at the bottom of page one and on about middle of the page on page two. So you'll notice that the only real shift of funds there for all funds is $2 million. Document number three is your UGF comparison. And here, the reason why it's up in the bottom of the page, you see it's up $146.8 million, or in the middle of the second page, you'll see it up $146.8 million. That is because when it came to the classification, once again, unfortunately, we're talking about fund source codes, the revenue replacement fund source code was labeled as UGF. So So that's why you see that shift there, but you don't see it in the federal funds that the co-chair was referring to. Beyond that, Mr. Painter probably could explain better than myself.
I probably shouldn't try to answer questions because, Reps Johnson, you might have been onto something. I think I was confusing FY22 and FY23. So what you're saying is, for comparison, we should be backing at the prior year, and maybe Alexi would be the better person. Mr. Painter, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Can you put yourself on the record? And if you've heard the question, can you maybe answer Representative Johnson's question?
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. So since those are UGF to UGF changes, if you're looking at the prior year, the budgets are comparable because all of that revenue replacement is still UGF. So in totals, there's not going to be a change. The only change would be if you're looking at the deficit number. So as long as you're using, you know, the pre-transfer deficit as our preference would be, there would be no change from year to year as a result of this.
Follow up?
So what you're saying is that if I compare the 22 management plan with the FY23, then those are, even if there was COVID or federal money in FY22 management plan, then those would compare directly with this FY23 budget, or would this have to have the federal money backed out of it?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson. So for the revenue replacement items, all of those are going to show up as UGF, so they will be comparable from year to year. That was kind of a deliberate strategy that Legislative Finance and OMB worked on last year to try to avoid these year-to-year distortions in the budget, was to keep revenue replacement as UGF, even though it's basically a tracking code so that OMB can report to the federal government where we spent our revenue replacement. The reports will still be comparable as if we didn't do revenue replacement. There were additive items last year. Most of them were actually in the FY21 supplemental because a lot of them were multi-year items, and that the goal was to get them out quickly. So I think really if you were trying to adjust the 22 budget for those items, the only ongoing item from FY22 to FY23 using the COVID funds would be that Department of Corrections DNA collections piece. That was a 22 item that's carrying forward to FY23. Beyond that, really these are sort of one-time uses in each year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to have to clarify this further offline. I'm not certain exactly how that's. It still feels like we would need to examine the federal funds in the FY22 budget.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Then we've got Representative Josephson and then Representative Thompson.
Okay, through the chair for Mr. Anderson. Revenue replacement last year, at least part of it, had to be defensible as replacement for lost local revenue, fish landing tax, et cetera. Are we in that same circumstance now?
Through the chair, that is my understanding, but Mr. Painter should answer that question.
Mr. Painter?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the revenue replacement calculation that was performed by Department of Revenue was done in accordance with the federal guidance, which allowed us to do the lost revenue collection by year. So we did demonstrate substantial lost revenue in fiscal years 20 and 21, which we can then take in any year of the qualifying period, which goes through the end of calendar year 24. So even though this year, you know, our revenue is looking better, we did demonstrate sufficient lost revenue in prior years that we have the ability to use all of the funds as revenue replacement to make up for those prior years.
So we don't have to prove up for each category lost revenue from cruise ship surcharges, and as long as they come from a single category, we can use that. So, for example,
although oil prices are considerably up, they were down as a result of the original shock of COVID, and we can still sort of piggyback on that. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that's correct. So because Alaska had sufficient lost revenue in 2020 and 2021, we could actually use our entire amount of the state and local fiscal relief fund across any of those years for revenue replacement. And they didn't say that you have to take the revenue replacement in the year the revenue was lost. It can be taken at any point during the period.
Okay. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Probably a question for Mr. Painter. On your document number one, the three items for the University of Alaska, the drones, the heavy oil, and minerals, these are all research-type items. Wouldn't they or couldn't they be put more into the capital budget instead of the operating budget?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, that's a great point. All three of those really are more traditionally capital items. The reason, you know, in speaking to OMB, the reason they put these in the operating budget was that the fund source of the SLRF, as we call it, is only available through December of 2024. And this is a multi-year item that will expire around then. So it makes it clear to the agency they only have the money for that period. But you're right that really this should be a capital item. And especially if this became a UGF-funded item, Ledge Finance would probably encourage you to move all of those to the capital budget, which is kind of the more appropriate home.
Mr. Anderson, do you have anything further with regard to your presentation?
Mr. Chairman, no, that concludes the rollout of the CS.
Okay. Let's see here. Let's take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record. I believe Representative Rasmussen, are you online? I was passed a note that said she was not showing up, but she was online. Representative Rasmussen? Okay, I don't hear her. So with that, we do have a motion before the committee, which was to adopt version W of the governor's operating budget, which simply just backed out the one-time federal ARPA funds. Again, just want to reiterate, it's our intention to use that. We have, we can use that $500 million all in FY23, or we can spread it out over FY23 and 24. So we have a motion to adopt this CS, and I will remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Hearing Representative Carpenter.
Just for the sake of getting this on the record, I'm jumping from one year to the next, and how we do our budgets is confusing to people. It's confusing to us in this room, and people outside are probably, if they were experienced last year, now they're wondering, scratching their heads, what's going on. So I guess that's more of a systemic comment, or a comment on our system of how we do budgets, than anything, but it is more confusing to me, and I'm going to spend more time digging into it, because it doesn't look like what it looked like last year in the way that we've explained it. So obviously we're going to move it forward, but we'll have to spend a good effort explaining this to people. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that, I think that is a good point, in that in the past there have always been debates over, the primary debate has been, do you use adjusted basis, are you using management plan, which version, are you using the actual numbers from the prior year, and then there's things that come in afterwards. For example, you've got salaries and contracts, and anyway, it has been an ongoing debate, and so this adds another wrinkle to that for sure. Representative Ortiz, do you have a question?
Brief comment along those same lines. I think one of the reasons why there's this fluctuation recently is obviously the recent fluctuation of federal money that we weren't dealing with up until COVID and then the appropriations. So that's one of the reasons why there's these changes, is because we're trying to adjust on the fly. Like last year, we were adjusting on the fly as to how to implement CRISA and other ARPA funds, etc. So part of it is, I think, is a result of what our current circumstances are, and I don't think they will continue to be this fluctuating in nature as the federal money goes away and it becomes much more predictable, is what my opinion is. And then also, just as a comment to your comments, while you're right, we can end up using these federal funds in the same way that the governor's proposing in the end, we also could find other uses for those monies. Yesterday I mentioned direction towards capital budget rather than some of these other revenue replacement options. So that's an option as well, correct?
Correct. Thank you, Representative Ortiz. And I guess just as my kind of a closer, I just ultimately what I'm trying to do is put downward pressure on spending. And so I think this will at least change the mindset a little bit and help folks to think of it in those terms. With that, are there any objections? I don't see any objections to this, and let's see here. Version W then will become the working draft for HB 281, and that next takes us up to a presentation from the Division of Legislative Finance. I think we're set up. Do we need a brief at ease, or are we good to go? I think we're good to go. Mr. Painter, are you still online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Painter is going to present to us the governor's 10-year plan and the baseline budgets with regard to that. So if you could, again, put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Sure. for the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division, and I'll be joined by Connor Bell, who's in the room, and he can operate the slides for the first half, and then he'll take over the last few slides. So today I'm going to be discussing a little more than just the 10-year plan and the baseline. We're going to start by going over what our modeling baseline is, compare the governor's budget 10-year plan to that baseline. We're going to show some outputs of our fiscal models and also discuss some additional items that could be considered in the baseline that are sort of dovetail with the CS that was in front of the committee right before this. And then we're going to show off our new probabilistic modeling tool, which kind of similar to what Callan presented to this committee a couple of days ago. So we go to slide 3. So our fiscal model is designed to show policymakers the longer-term impact of fiscal policy decisions. Our baseline assumptions are essentially that the current budget level levels are maintained, adjusted for inflation, and then any policy changes can then be applied against that baseline as sort of a even starting point. Our default is to assume that statutory formulas will be followed, and that includes statewide items as well as the permanent fund dividend. The next few slides will go through a few of those assumptions in a little greater depth. Slide 4. So our revenue assumptions, our baseline revenue assumption is the Department of Revenue's fall revenue forecast that assumes $71 oil in FY23 following futures market thereafter. Obviously, we've seen their updated numbers for just FY22 and FY23. We're not incorporating that at this point because that doesn't go the entire length of the period. So we'll keep using the fall forecast until we get the spring forecast in a couple of months. We're using DNR's oil production forecast, which projects an increase in Alaska North Slope production from about 500,000 barrels a day next year to 586,000 barrels a day by the end of the modeling period. And for the permanent fund, we're using Callan's return assumption, which is a 5.86% total return in the current fiscal year and then 6.20% in following years. Next slide. On the spending side, for agency operations, we start with the governor's FY23 budget and then assume it grows with inflation. We're using Callan's 2% number. As you heard a couple of days ago, there's kind of potential that that's going to be revised upwards in the future, but that's still their official number. So that's what we're using at this point. For statewide items, we are assuming that all items are funded to their statutory levels beyond FY23. That includes obviously the dividend, as well as school debt reimbursement, the REAA fund capitalization, community assistance, oil and gas tax credits, and so on. With capital budget, we're starting with the governor's FY23 capital budget and then assuming that grows with inflation, again, 2%. And then for supplementals, we're assuming $50 million a year, which is based on the average amount of supplementals we have minus any lapsing appropriations. So that's kind of a five-year average from the pre-COVID era, when both of those numbers have gone a lot higher. Next slide. So this next slide shows our modeling baseline, including that statutory dividend. So that would have an FY23, a deficit of about $1.48 billion, and deficits in the following years ranging from about $1 billion to $1.4 billion. And so that would quickly go through the CBR and require additional draws from the ERA in order to make those budget levels based on that statutory dividend and all of the other assumptions. So obviously the governor's 10-year plan does not call for that. The next slide shows some of the policy changes proposed in the governor's 10-year plan relative to our baseline. So the most significant is that he is proposing a PFD that's 50% of the POMV draw. He's also including an FY22 supplemental so that the FY22 PFD would equal that 50% of the percent of market value draw. That alone is a reduction of about $1 billion and is by far the largest change here. Agency operations in the governor's plan are held flat in FY24, and then in following years, all items but Medicaid grow at 1.5% versus our inflation assumption of 2%, and Medicaid, they assume, grows at 1%. That kind of works out to a compound growth rate of something like 1.4%, but they do project those separately. And then while in FY23, as you heard last week, the governor fully funds the statewide items other than the dividend. Starting in FY24, his 10-year plan calls for reductions to those items. So school debt reimbursement is funded at 50%, and the REAA fund is reduced to a flat $17.5 million. That's just over 50% funding. They also assume that the PERS and TERS healthcare contributions are not funded. That was a kind of one-year policy decision made by the Arm Board last year that I think you heard a bit about last week in my presentation and Mr. Steininger's presentation. Their assumption is that that is maintained, whereas our default is that it is not, since it was kind of pitched as a one-time item. Their capital budget, they are holding that flat with no inflationary growth. They do have, they're assuming the general obligation bond is issued in FY23, and that causes a debt service increase in future years, but no increase to the capital budget. And then they assume that supplementals and LAPs would cancel out. And then, of course, as we've just discussed, the governor uses $375 million of ARPA revenue replacement to help close the deficit this year.
Mr. Paint, question from Representative Joseph.
Thank you to the chair. Mr. Painter, the middle bullet item there, PERS and TERS health care contributions not funded. So I'm the author of House Bill 55 in its original form, and that's a defined benefit bill that tells a future tier you're not getting any special health insurance because it's just too expensive to include in the package. And it blows up the unfunded liability. I know the Arm Board said we're okay for this fiscal year, and somehow the governor thinks for the next decade retirees don't need any additional health care funding? Is that what that bullet says?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, so back when we first had sort of the current unfunded liability opening up, we had two funds split up for our retirement fund. There's a pension fund and then there's a healthcare fund. And when we did the additional state contribution in FY14, that went to both funds based on their funded ratio at the time. Since then, AlaskaCare, which is the retiree healthcare program, as well as what provides healthcare to some state employees, has actually held its cost significantly below the actuarial expectations from FY14. This year we have an increase to the AlaskaCare rate for state employees, but it's the first time in several years they've actually significantly kind of beat the cost curve through a number of cost-saving measures that I'm sure that division would be happy to tell you about. The result is that in the actuarial analysis, that fund is funded at greater than a 100% ratio, even if we don't provide additional state contributions over the next 15 years while we still have the unfunded liability. Part of the caution that the Arm Board had was, yes, it's over 100% now. We're undergoing an experience study right now that could possibly change that, so they wanted to sort of take it a year at a time. But based on the current actuarial projections, that system is fully funded and there would be no particular need to continue funding the healthcare side. The pension side is still underfunded, but this was just specifically to the healthcare fund.
Well, all I'll say, Mr. Chair, is I have total confidence in Mr. Painter, and I don't doubt for a second anything he said. It's just completely counterintuitive. But because all we've been hearing about, I've been here, this is my 10th year, is the cost of healthcare is rising. Complete our collective bargaining agreements and on and on. So I'm going to just watch this and see what happens. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, maybe it's evidence that those arguments in the past were not actually accurate. Thank you.
Okay. See no further questions. Mr. Painter.
Okay, going on to slide 8. So then, other than the policy choices, there is one difference in assumptions that makes a bit of a difference. So as some of you may recall from the fiscal plan working group discussions last year, the school bond debt reimbursement program has a moratorium right now that's scheduled to end after FY25. And our assumption had previously been that we use the established debt schedule. There's no additional debt even once the moratorium expires. The fiscal plan working group kind of decided that that wasn't an accurate baseline, and for their own projections, assumed that new debt would resume once the moratorium ended. And, you know, after we sort of looked at that, Ledge Finance decided that that is probably more representative of the current law. So if the legislature wishes to have the moratorium extend beyond, then you would need to pass a bill to extend it. And so our baseline assumes that new school debt is added starting, I think, in FY27 after a bit of a delay. OMB is still using kind of the way that we had previously done it, which is to not have new school debt being added past the moratorium. As I understand it, that's still sort of just an assumption difference. That's not necessarily reflective of the governor intending to pass a limit on an extension of the moratorium. But that is, you know, it's a few million dollars a year. It makes it so if you look at our model versus the OMB 10-year plan, there is a little bit of a difference. There's some presentation differences that I think we discussed last week about, you know, where we reflect fund transfers. We also have slightly different starting numbers from the CBR. OMB is using draft actual numbers from FY21. We're waiting on the audited numbers to update from what we used last year, because last year we saw some very large audit adjustments, so we're just going to wait. Hopefully should be just another few weeks to get those numbers. It's the difference there is a couple hundred million dollars, which because it's a fund balance doesn't make a huge difference, but it does make a little bit of a difference in how robust the CBR is throughout this period.
We've got okay. A question, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, it's not a question for Alexi. I don't disagree with what he's referenced up there in regards to the fiscal plan working group, but we must also keep in mind that the assumptions and the recommendations coming out of the fiscal policy or fiscal working group there, our intention was not to cherry pick the things that we wanted to highlight or use out of that. The intent was that we're looking at a comprehensive plan that we need to work on. And I would just caution us to not cherry pick either assumptions or recommendations coming out of the fiscal policy working group as representative of something that the policy group worked on or agreed to outside of a comprehensive agreement.
Thank you. Mr. Painter?
Okay, so continuing on to slide 9, this next slide shows a comparison overall of the governor's 10-year plan to our baseline. The next few slides will break that down into the various component parts, but this gives you the overall picture. So in FY23, the difference is really just that supplemental assumption. In FY24, you see that there's about a $200 million difference. That's due to the essentially year of flat budgets that is proposed by the governor, where there's no inflationary growth, as well as switching to a 50% funding of a couple of the statewide items. And then following years, you see that amount just sort of compounds a little bit. That's a combination of that year of flat budgets not having compound growth, and then also the slower growth rates. So by FY31, those policy changes proposed by the governor result in a budget that's about $400 million less than LFT's baseline. One thing I'll just highlight, because it's generated questions before, there's in our baseline, there's a drop between FY25 and 26 in the budget number. And the reason for that is the oil and gas tax credits. If we follow the statutory appropriations, we'll pay those off in FY26. And that results in a pretty large decrease in the budget, as that goes from a couple hundred million a year to, I think, you know, a small amount in 1 year and then zero beyond that. And that'll be a little more apparent in a couple of slides. Going on to slide 10, so this specifically is looking at agency operations. And this is really highlighting the difference that flat budget year and then the growth rates make. You know, when we talk about 2% or 1.5%. It doesn't sound like a big difference, but really over the course of, you know, I guess 8 years of compounding, that does start to add up quite a bit where, you know, an $80 million difference, just that flat budget year in the first year, becomes a $270 million difference by the last year just because of that, the different growth rate. So that is a surprisingly powerful policy change over the long term. Going on to slide 11, this shows the statewide items. And so here you can see that the graph below, the darker lines show the LFD baseline, the lighter lines on the right, or bars, show the governor's numbers. And you can see that, you know, there's a little bit of a difference in debt service reflected by the school debt amount. There's a pretty significant difference in retirement due to the assumption that healthcare will not be funded. And then in fund capitalizations, that's really reflecting the REAA fund amount. They're identical in oil tax credits, which is the other major item there. So in terms of statewide items, the difference between the governor's plan and the baseline is somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 to $70 million a year, depending on the year. Okay, so moving on to slide 12. Slide 12 shows our modeling baseline, but we've made that largest assumption change, which is switching to from the statutory dividend to the 50% of percent of market value draw dividend. I think that gives kind of a cleaner comparison to the governor's 10-year plan to have the same dividend scenario, since that is by far the largest item. So if you look at our modeling baseline and plug in the 50-50 plan, no other policy changes, we would have about a $400 million deficit in FY23. Again, that's a little larger than the 350 we've been talking about because of the supplementals we've been assuming. And then that grows a little bit in FY24 to $483 million and then shrinks down to about $300 million a year in some of the later years. So kind of a persistent deficit absent the governor's other policy changes. So just the dividend change is not alone is not enough to close the deficit in this model. Next slide, slide 13, shows what happens when we put the governor's 10-year plan into the LFD model. And so these numbers are very close to what the governor's 10-year plan itself shows. I think those have slightly smaller deficits because of the school debt assumption, but they're very close. And you can see that this results in deficits in FY23, 24, and 25 that are fairly significant, $200 million or more. After that, the deficits are and surplus in the last year within $100 million. We would say that, you know, given the accuracy of the forecast, within $100 million is close enough to balance. We don't claim to have enough accuracy that, you know, a $33 million deficit is significant. And this is really in line with the governor's own projections. So, you know, I'm presenting this in part just to highlight that if you do make all these policy changes, we would agree with the governor's analysis that that would basically close the deficit in the next few years. Okay, go.
I'm sorry, Mr. Painter. Representative Josephson.
Chair, remind me, Mr. Painter, when you say if we do make all these policy changes, can you tell us again what the all these policy changes are?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes. So that's those items that are listed on slide 7. So the most material is going to be the year of no budget growth next year, where we hold the budget flat, and then the slower growth rates, as well as partial funding of numerous statewide items. Those are sort of the policy changes that the governor is proposing that make a significant difference to the spending in future years.
Since Representative Wool is gone, he's the other member, but we had a Ways and Means Committee meeting today. ASHNA does not agree that 1% growth in Medicaid is sustainable. The providers will just leave and not provide. And then we heard from school board organizations like Lisa Paradis. The BSA is down 500 or more in real spending since, I don't know,
So, and every department has massive turnover. So just to keep those things in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edgman and Carpenter.
And I think that's my exact concern as well, that you know, the actual budget process is multidimensional. This to me feels like it's not inclusive of all those dimensions and really is a more narrow view, because I could argue that there should be a third scenario here where you have the historic level of the PFD, because that's what the legislature has done since 2016, which is, you know, average out about $1,100 or so, to put that perspective in there. And I understand the intent of this is to compare, you know, the 50-50 PFD with a full PFD and then some sort of narrow range of assumptions going forward, but like Representative Josephson just talked about, real world intervenes and Medicaid goes that way, or the population of the state goes way up and our education costs go way up, and a bunch of things that really make all of this an academic exercise. But I, you know, I appreciate the intent, I think I know where we're going with this, but I'm a little uncomfortable when I hear the statement that, oh, in a few years the governor's 50-50 works out. Well, to me, that's not complete. There are so many other factors that we need to talk about before we can get to that statement. You know, I would really be comfortable having a third scenario in here so we can complete the low, mid, high case scenario analysis, because right now I feel like it's mid and high case scenario. And again, a lot of it's built around the permanent fund dividend, the gaps. Everything else you could say we're almost in precise alignment with where the administration is now in terms of the spending side, until of course you get to what happens in the real world over time, which none of us can predict or forecast or anticipate. Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Yeah, thank you. A couple points. I really do appreciate that first bullet there, and I do think that we should have that conversation that you were just alluding to. 50% of POMV is following the law. The statute directly definitely says that whatever the income amount is determined, 50% of it is supposed to be transferred into the dividend fund. The question is, how do you determine the income? The POMV model is one way, 21% of net earnings is the other way. So what would it look like if we were using 21% earnings, which is by law just as legitimate as 50% or 5% of the POMV? So it is a legitimate question that we should ask ourselves. And I'll have to raise my hand again because I forgot my other point.
Okay. Representative LeBlanc.
And just for clarity's sake, the 50% of POMV is not current law. Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Yeah, sorry, I remember the other. This question was to Alexi. The assumptions made in the graphs here are also following current projections for growth of the permanent fund earnings, or the permanent fund and its earnings, based on a 5% POMV, and the fall forecast oil and gas revenue. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carpenter, yes, that's accurate.
Okay. And I see no further questions. Mr. Painter?
Okay, so kind of getting to some of the points that couple of the members made. Going on to slide 14, you know, one of the questions is, should the baseline be higher? So there's several ongoing items in the governor's budget that are funded with short-term federal funds. These are sort of the items that were taken out in the CS earlier. Even if we do use federal funds for a lot of these now, those federal funds won't last forever. So in the next couple of slides, we'll make some adjustments to show what happens when we replace those with UGF. So the first is that DNA tracking program, that's $1.1 million. That's an ongoing program. Many of the other uses of the SLRF are truly one-time items, but this one is not. For the Alaska Marine Highway System, when the infrastructure bill money is gone in 5 years, that would need to be replaced with UGF. That's about $82 million at the service level proposed by the governor this year. And then there's the other DOT uses of federal funds. And then, of course, when we talked about the retiree health care, we backed that out as a statewide item. but that also played into the rates that were the amounts that are paid by state agencies. That reduced the budget this year by $15.9 million throughout agency budgets. So if we assume that that's a one-time cut and that will come back next year, again, that would raise the baseline. So in slide 15, we show all of those items and how they would impact the baseline if they were put back to UGF when their current fund source expires. So in FY24, that would be the DNA item, the expiring federal funds in DOT, and then the PERS healthcare. Starting FY27, AMHS would also need to go back to UGF under the governor's numbers. Altogether, these items are about $39 million in the next few years and then $121 million beyond that. So again, this isn't really talking about changing the the growth rate or anything like this. This is just replacing federal funds. And that would, if you adjust for those things, then that increases the difference between our baseline and the governor's budget. So then it, pretty minor difference those first few years. But by FY31, that does mean that there's over a $500 million difference between our baseline and the governor's plan when you add this additional $121 million. And again, if members feel that the growth rate of inflation is insufficient, that would be an area where you would probably support a policy change in the opposite direction of the governor's proposal.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Painter, this doesn't address things like the Alaska Reads Act and costs associated with that, does it? Or other fiscal notes that would be adopted with past legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, no, this does not address any fiscal notes of legislation that is not yet passed. The governor did not build in any of those into his sort of 10-year plan or long-term projection. And so if they do pass, that would increase the budget going forward.
Follow up?
And without knowing, obviously most bills don't pass, but there are hundreds of bills. I just mentioned the Alaska Reads Act, but you could multiply that $20 million or whatever was needed by a magnitude of 10. We can't know what will pass, and we certainly can't know what will pass in FY 28, 29, or 30, correct?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct. Those would all be policy changes relative to our baseline. If we're passing new bills and increasing spending, that's a policy change. In past years, the governor has incorporated policy changes into his baseline in some cases. But in this case, he has not. And, if the legislature is doing this exercise, I would encourage you to include any policy changes that you would like to see into your own projections going forward.
That's certainly fair. Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
All right. So moving on to the next slide.
I'm sorry, Mr. Painter. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lexi, on the issue of the once the federal money goes away in support of the AMHS operations, the $82 million returns to a number, of FY22? Is that what we're talking about? Why you chose that $82 million figure?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So that figure is comprised of kind of two numbers added together, which in that document for the CS, those were broken out. So in FY22, the amount of UGF that went to the Marine Highway represented 1 year, even though we were actually funding a year and a half. And that was $63.4 million. However, that also included changes for Senate Bill 55, the retirement bill, that were 18 months worth of changes. And so if we're really representing that as a one-year budget, then the calendar year 22 funding level of UGF would be $59.4 million going forward, based on our calculations. The governor is also proposing a service increase that would increase the budget by $22.6 million. Those added together are $82 million. So that $82 million represents essentially the service level proposed in the governor's current budget, not the current service level that we have right now, which is a little bit lower than what the governor's proposing.
And as just a follow-up and for a little bit more folks' understanding of the history of the AMHS, I think it's accurate to say that back in 2015, the AMHS was for operations was funded with UGF for right around $140 million. Is that accurate, or do you have any recollection of that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I do not remember the numbers from that period.
Anyway, just to illustrate, you know, we talk about it as a service increase, but we're a long ways away from where we were in service back in 2014 or 2015, but that's for a later debate. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Okay, so going on to the next slide, we're kind of shifting gears to talk about our probabilistic modeling, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Bell for that. I'll just provide a little stage setting before I turn it over. So, you know, the committee heard a couple of days ago from Callan and Associates, which has done some probabilistic modeling of the permanent fund for the Permanent Fund Corporation. Department of Revenue used to run probabilistic scenarios as well, and we wanted to have our own tool to do that because sometimes that can be a helpful tool to understand the permanent fund. And so we've developed that, and today we're just presenting a few scenarios, pretty limited, mostly to demonstrate the capability, and we'd be happy to work with members to provide additional scenarios going forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Bell.
You can put yourself on the record.
For the record, this is Connor Bell with Legislative Finance. As Alexi noted, Callan presented to you earlier this week with probabilistic modeling, and they covered specifically the permanent fund. They have more, basically, a more elaborate model than we do of the permanent fund, which they take a lot into account. However, our model is comprehensive in that it looks at Alaska's budget and revenue picture and how that feeds in to potential overdraws from the permanent fund. So our modeling, it runs 2,000 different trials for every scenario, basically changing the assumptions of the permanent fund earnings, the oil prices, and oil production. The baseline is the same as what Alexi discussed. It's our legislative finance baseline budget. We hold inflation constant. And we differ some ways from what Callan did. We assume that there is no inflation proofing until FY25 due to the legislative intent of the inflation proofing transfer in FY20. And they also vary inflation rates by year. So the return we use for Permanent Fund Corp is the 6.2 average return with a 13.2% standard deviation, which is Callan's assumption. And that basically means there's a 16% likelihood of returns being below -7% in any given year, and a 16% chance of returns being above 19% in any given year. For oil price, it's based on the fall forecast, but then we apply a standard deviation equal to 34% of a given year's average price. The fall revenue sources book has a high and low set of price scenarios, and that's actually a wider distribution than what we're modeling here. So if we were to use that price distribution from Department of Revenue's forecast, it would show a slightly wider distribution of outcomes here. But this is basically a more tightly bound analysis, and it's not to say that DORs is incorrect. This is just what we're using for illustrative purposes. And otherwise, this is partly just an example of what we can provide to legislative offices, so we're happy to, upon request, run any scenarios under these models. So the next few slides look at the stress test under different levels of the permanent fund dividend. First, we're looking at the statutory PFD. The blue bar that's horizontal represents the median expected outcome, which is slightly different from the mean that we talk about, so it's going to be a little different from what you see in our main, our typical analysis. And you'll notice that the vertical black bar, it ranges from the 10th percentile to the 90th percentile of expected outcomes. The blue bar is towards the bottom of that because of the skew of revenues, where the difference between a $20 and $30 oil price doesn't generate that difference in a overall revenue, while as the difference between an $80 and $90 oil price has a huge difference. And we've seen that over the years, of course, that at the higher levels, price has a much bigger impact on revenue. And so under the statutory PFD, the median deficit is about $1 to $1.5 billion each year, though deficits of $2.5 billion or surpluses of $5 billion are also possible. And also just to note, the black bars associate the likelihood in any given year. So the likelihood of basically in FY23, the actual deficit or the actual surplus being above that $2.5 billion there is about 10%. The odds of it being at the top of the black bar or higher on every single year is much lower than that. So that's just to say that we're not correlating the returns and different in prices year to year. And so that creates more randomness where you could see a $3 billion deficit one year and a $4 billion surplus the next year.
Question, Representative Carpenter.
And you just want to clarify, when we say statutory PFD, we're talking about 21% of net earnings and 50% of determination, whatever that dollar figure is, to the permanent fund dividend. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, yes, that is correct. All right, moving on to slide 18. Now we're looking at the same chart, but for a 50-50 PFD, which is 50% of the percent of market value draw, which is what the governor is proposing. And the median deficit here is around $300 to $500 million. The low is about $1.3 to $1.6 billion deficits, and the surpluses range from $4 to $6 billion. Moving on to slide 19, this is looking at an $1,100 per person PFD. Representative Edgman mentioned this figure, and this is just to look at basically paying a PFD under close to current history and what we paid the last year. And so under that $1,100 PFD, we're seeing about a $500 million to $1 billion per year surplus, and a up to $700 million of deficits at the low end, or in some years, just a zero surplus, and surpluses possibly as high as, over $7 to $8 billion. So as you can see, there is a huge range of the possible outcomes, especially for the high end of oil price and production. We could see serious windfalls, or we could not. All right, moving on to the last slide. This is looking at something that Callan had done this and showed a very similar chart for just comparing different ERA overdraws and their effect on the likelihood of an ERA shortfall. And so by ERA shortfall, we basically mean that the earnings reserve account is emptied out, so there's no money left in it, so we're not able to basically draw the entire POMV draw for government services. And so for the first couple of years, under all the scenarios, it's impossible, essentially under our assumptions, for that to happen. Since we have at this moment, we have a very healthy balance in the earnings reserve, or we have a big balance of unrealized gains that will be earned and realized as statutory net income and brought into the earnings reserve over the next couple of years. And once we get into FY26, the possibility of over shortfalls increase, and by FY31, there's almost a 30% chance of overdraw under the statutory PFD scenario, and about an 18% likelihood under an $1,100 per person PFD scenario.
Representative Josephson and then Representative Carpenter.
Through the chair, when you say, Mr. Bell, when you say overdraw, you mean depletion of the ERA in full, correct? You don't mean an overdraw beyond 5%. You mean there's no money.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that's correct. I meant to say that it is a shortfall in the way that the ERA, the earnings reserve balance is zero, and there is money in the permanent fund, but it's all in the principal, and so we are unable to spend any of it. So yes, basically it is having no money in the earnings reserve at all.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So as a function of the health of the state's economy, we might measure GDP as kind of the output. During these scenarios, what are we assuming as a growth or a time factor for the GDP? How does that relate?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, GDP doesn't directly come into this specific modeling. Of course, that is a factor. The biggest thing is oil prices, and that's what we're changing here. But under all the scenarios, you can imagine, non-petroleum revenues being higher. Under a higher GDP scenario, at this point, non-petroleum revenues are much smaller. So, in short, we're not accounting for differences in GDP except for that caused by differences in oil prices.
So, just a comment on this to highlight the problem that we have. Most people in the state work in the non-oil industries, and the decision that we're faced with here on how to pay for state government is totally irrespective of where most people work and where they earn their living. And with the exception of oil revenue, as you've pointed out, and maybe corporate income tax for some corporations who pay corporate income taxes, the state budget is not even, it's not even concerned with it. So as we're looking forward into the future, we're looking at how to spend money that has no relationship to anybody else within the state. Most people where they work within the state. So the question would be, I would like to see, is what happens if we have a 2% increase in GDP over the next decade, and that GDP reflects some sort of a increase in state spending, then where would we be?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, yeah, we'd be happy to provide that analysis. Basically, and we can discuss the specifics, but basically we can assume that budgets and other aspects of possibly revenue that grows at a higher rate than anticipated.
I'll follow up on that request. I think it's key to our discussions, and you might be asking where am I going with this, but we're going to have conversations about what portion of the federal money and what portion of the earnings and all of that goes to the state government. And what we're not asking ourselves is, how do we grow our economy? What are we doing to grow that private sector portion of the economy that's not even tied to the state government? That's where everybody lives and works. So what policies we do now are going to impact where that grows, and that's what people want to see, is a growing economy. And if that economy is tied to this chart showing if it grows, we have more state spending, then maybe we'll have a conversation about what policies are going to be needed to grow that economy. Oil, fishing, non-oil, agriculture, those types of things that diversify the economy. If they're tied to this, then we care that those things are going to happen. Thank you.
Okay. And in line, I've got Representative Rasmussen and then Representative Edgman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And through the chair, I guess I'm curious how you derive the 30% or 18% surety that the earnings reserve would be depleted by 2026 or 2031. I couldn't fully hear the dates there, but it seems like as unknown, I guess, as the oil revenue will be, and just with volatility in the budget cycle, I'm curious how you're able to, 18% is a very specific number, so how do you get to that?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. So yeah, we are basically modeling a range of oil prices and production and permit fund returns. And basically, even the ranges you use are somewhat subjective. And so this isn't, we're not precisely saying it's 18%. It might give a look of misleading precision, but based on the ranges of different variables, like how much variation year to year we expect in oil prices and things like that, and putting that into our overall fiscal model, that's how we get it something like the 18% likelihood of the ERA balance being zero by the end of FY31.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So, I guess given how uncertain, I mean, that's forecasting 10 years out. We don't know what future legislatures are going to do with their policy is. We don't know what oil levels do.
Representative Rasmussen, you're breaking up. Representative Rasmussen, you're breaking up pretty bad. We're catching very little of what you're saying.
Thank you.
Okay, sorry about that. Thanks. Next question to Representative Edgman.
So I really, I appreciate the model coming before us, and I understand that, it is subjective. It's basically an educated guess looking into the future. And maybe a couple questions. The first question would be the easiest, and that is the obvious, with an obvious answer. This is the first year Ledge Finance has developed and used this model. Is that correct, or am I?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, as far as I'm aware, yes, it may have been some past time, and Department of Revenue has done some modeling in past years of this, but as far as I'm aware, yes, that's correct.
And I ask that just to establish that, and I don't see Alexei nodding his head or shaking his head in the background there. So it's a firm fact then. But I would look forward to this model being developed a little bit more in the future, and I'm sure Ledge Finance will put a lot of work into that. And my theme is constant. In the real world of budgeting, you have to look at both sides of the ledger, of course, the money coming in and the money going out. And just on the demand side, in terms of the probability of Alaskan population growing X amount, or spending growing X amount, or maybe declining X amount, whatever, I'd like to, in the future, see those probabilities built in so we get a more well-rounded approach, other than beyond basically taking the revenue side and projecting forward, but the spending is on a continuum. It just rises, 2%, everything sort of stays steady and equal and just sort of, linear, and that's not the real world. It just isn't. I don't offer that as a criticism at all, but just to say that I look forward to future iterations, because I'm sure you'll be able to build all that in.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Clarification on the 50-50 POMV middle column here. Is that representative of the governor's plan or just a theoretical single split of the 50-50 POMV?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, it does not implement everything in the governor's plan, just basically paying out a permanent fund dividend equal to 50% of the POMV draw. So it doesn't have as other policy changes. It also doesn't include a supplemental PFD in FY22.
So follow up, I think that might be key here too to the plan here, because if I'm not mistaken, the governor's plan actually rolls the ERA into the corpus. So thus a prediction or a projection probability that the ERA would have a shortfall, we would have to explain that because there wouldn't be an ERA in that scenario. So what would that mean? Would that just mean there wouldn't be a payment from the permanent fund that year? There wouldn't be an ERA, so we need to see that scenario.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think some of Callan's modeling shows that. So basically under the governor's plan, the earnings reserve and principal would be combined, and so there would be no possibility of overdraws. And so that our current modeling is showing how our budget deficits are possibly feed into permanent fund overdraws. I would defer in a lot of instances to Callan as far as if it's just looking at the permanent fund modeling itself, is if there's no overdraws, I think they might do a better job at looking at the likelihood. And they showed to the committee some band of likelihood that even if you don't overdraw at all, it's possible that, I guess if there is no principal and earnings reserve, then there basically there's no chance of an ERA overdraw because the concept no longer exists.
And that's kind of what I was getting at, Mr. Chair, is if a plan was put together where there is no ERA, what does the number represent? Does it just mean that there is no payment from the permanent fund that year? We're saying it's an ERA shortfall, but if there is no ERA, then it means something different. And that's kind of the modeling that we should be looking at it as well, because that's what the governor's proposing, is that those policy changes. So if the policy change is put into place, then what do those numbers mean? Not an ERA shortfall, because it wouldn't be an ERA. It would mean, I think, it would just mean that we wouldn't have a payment from the permanent fund that year.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, we'd be happy to run some modeling like that. Basically, we would be showing unfilled deficits in deficit scenarios, because this, in our modeling, basically, the ERA is serving as a last chance reserve for filling these unfilled deficits. And so under that, you would see basically these unfilled gaps, and then the permanent fund would just be one entity. And since it's a large $80 billion plus fund, the likelihood of the permanent fund itself going to zero is negligible. And so you would expect to be able to have a POMV draw every year. There's no likelihood of basically that going away entirely under a scenario where the principal and earnings reserve are combined.
I guess that
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. What I understood earlier from Representative Josephson's question, I think, was that when we're saying a shortfall of the ERA, we're not talking about a shortfall from the 5% of the market value draw, which I'm understanding you to say that would continue regardless. But if the ERA wasn't there in a separate model, not the model we're looking at now, if the ERA wasn't there, then what would the negative piece be? I'm saying probability of an ERA shortfall is the negative piece. Are we saying that there wouldn't be a payment from the permanent fund?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, in a scenario basically where the earnings reserve is combined into the principal, the POMV draw wouldn't necessarily change. It would just be paid out of the permanent fund itself, and that would create basically a constitutional barrier from drawing anything in excess of the POMV draw.
Otherwise known as a spending limit.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I can jump in on that question.
Mr. Painter?
One thing I would add through the chair, Representative Carpenter, is right now in our model, essentially the failure point is when the ERA runs out. If you constitutionalize the POMV draw, that's no longer the failure point. The failure point would then move to when does the CBR run out. And so it reduces the – it's going to greatly increase the likelihood that we would have insufficient money to pay for the budget, because you won't have the ERA to draw upon. It takes away one source of failure, which is that, you know, the ERA itself would be gone, but it would, you know, increase the chance that we wouldn't have enough money to pay for the budget because of the lack of that fund as a deficit filler. So it'd be an interesting model, because it could work both ways.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, for either gentleman. Again, I see the scenarios you ran and the varying assumptions. Does this page 20, similar to my question 20, 30 minutes ago, this uses LFD's 2% inflation and no fiscal notes, no new fiscal notes, or what?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that's correct. It uses basically what Alexei had detailed in LFD's legislative finances baseline, and so it's assuming that 2% annual increase of agency operations.
So it's just, if I can follow up, it's just interesting to think of a world with no fiscal notes. It would eliminate a lot of bills, for sure. But so these the highest numbers in the bottom at FY31, those would just go up with fiscal notes, obviously.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, if those fiscal notes were revenue negative, if they led to more expenditures than revenue, then yes, that's correct.
Okay. I see no further comments, and so if there are none from Mr. Painter or Mr. Bell, we'll wrap this up here. Just a quick announcement. Co-chair Representative Merrick will be holding a hearing on Wednesday, February 2nd at 9 a.m. to hear legislation. And that meeting will be fairly quick. She will consider three bills, all of which have already had amendment deadlines in the past. But as it is a new year, she wanted to set a deadline if members had additional amendments. Amendments are due to Representative Merrick's office by 6 p.m. on Monday, January 31st, for the following three bills. The three bills are House Bill 54, which is invasive species management by the House Fisheries Committee. There's HB 90, which is the vehicle rentals and vehicle rental networks by Representative Wool. And then House Bill 111, which is the dental hygienist advanced practice permit by Representative Sponholz. And so if there's nothing to come for this committee, we will be meeting tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. and we will hear from OMB Director Neil Steininger on the governor's proposed capital budget as well as the GO bond bill. So we will be adjourned at 3:24 p.m. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Ortiz.
What time of that 9 a.m. meeting? What day was that?
That will be Wednesday, February 2nd at 9 a.m., and it will be to hear those three bills. And the amendment deadline will be on January 31st at 6 p.m., which is a Monday.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll be adjourned. Thank you, everyone, and it's 3:24 p.m.